Hello, everybody. Let me turn off the music and hope that we don't start this time like we usually start when I run this show, where nobody can hear me or I'm echoey and all this stuff. Hype, hype, freaking bats. What's up, Syntax? Trimark Jake, thanks for stopping by.
Did you change the spelling of my name? I can't tell because it's kind of pixelated.
No, your name, you're Dave, right? I thought that's what we did last time. Sorry, do you want me to change it?
No, that's fine.
Welcome, everyone. It is time for the Trimark Happy Hour in true fashion. We just kind of start. We just kind of jump right into it and everything. So, as you can tell, I'm in your bottom left-hand corner, so I'm running the show today. Danny is on vacation, taking good care of himself and just kind of chilling out, as far as I understand. I'm joined today with Dave, Bad Code, Bad Lou, and Jim Security, Psychority, as well as our esteemed guest today, Nathan McNulty. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, City Comments.
Absolutely.
What did that one say?
Dave, you are super quiet. It's because he's just mumbling.
Wow, thanks. I hope you're choking that water.
Yeah, I'm going to need some more water here in a second. You guys make me drink too much. So, Nathan, let's just start off by, why don't you tell the people who aren't here for you, they're here to listen to me say stupid stuff on stream instead. Why don't you just briefly introduce yourself, tell us kind of where you're currently working, a little bit about where you came from, how you kind of, started out, what you enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so, hey everybody, Nathan McNulty, Senior Security Solutions Architect at Patriot Consulting. I've been doing that for about 2.5 years. Originally started out in engineering, spent about 5 years on help desk, kind of moved from Ghost to BDD when I moved there, got that going on MDT and then Config Manager. So I was doing the sysadmin stuff while being help desk position, right? Good experience growing there. Moved over to a school district, managing there. I was a client architect for them. Halfway through, had a BEC that kind of moved me over into a security role. Also, when I got there, we had a Linux admin managing 80, so I kind of took over that. And then Business Productivity Online Suite, back before it was Office 365. So I migrated our email and all that and just kind of took over everything that was like Microsoft stack related. And yeah, so migrated to Solid Cloud. I've been running with Azure AD for 13 years now, or Entra ID now, I guess. But yeah, so moved up to kind of a security role there, implemented most of the E5 security stack, or all of it, I guess, at the time it was available. And then I went over to oil, gas, and water, technically. So doing some ICS and some fun stuff there for about 6 months, 7 months, something like that. And then Patriot Consulting actually hired me on as a consultant to implement E5 security, Intune, Intra, Azure security, and I was doing Purview for a while as well, the compliance side, but it wasn't fun, so I'm just kidding. I just couldn't keep up with all of it. It's moving so fast, so I finally had to cut out on some things, but yeah. So that's the crash course. It's been a fun time, 17, 18 years now. Pretty cool.
That sounds awesome.
We don't say Entra, we say Azure. Yeah, we're at Azure family.
Azure AD, yeah.
Yeah. That's when you've worked in it for what you said been in it for 13 years and it was Azure AD for 12 of those 13 years.
Totally. Yeah. And it's funny because I try really hard to say Entra ID and then the Copilot stuff, it's all still like converts it all back to Azure AD for me. Like, I know I didn't say it once in that call and yet every single time there it is.
I was just looking through documentation today and realized that they had changed the, or they created the subdomain for entra.microsoft.com now. So it's instead of the azure.portal, it's now Entra, and they've changed. So it's the same stuff. It's just a black heading instead of a blue heading.
Yeah, it's framed in differently. There's actually a couple extra sections in there as well that are only available in the Entra portal. If you go down, there's like a permissions management, and then global secure access is going to be down in there as well, which is pretty cool. I'm excited for that one to come along.
That's awesome. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's always so exciting to realize how many people have such similar stories, or so many of us kind of come from that help desk sysadmin style, move into security. I like to always say that I was doing security for probably 2 or 3 years before I knew that I was doing security, right? I thought it was just sysadmin and stuff. So it's always cool to see how many of us kind of cut our teeth on that and kind of moved into more security based stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. It's easy to spot all the mistakes because I've already made them all. Well, I haven't made all of them, but you know what I mean? Like, it's like, oh, how would I have handled? Oh yeah, that was probably not good back when I did that. And then you just see it everywhere. You're like, hey, cool. Other people had the same thought, which wasn't a secure thought, but yeah, they did it the same way I did. Right.
Yeah. And it kind of gives you that empathy whenever you're talking with a customer in doing consulting, right? Where you say, hey, we see this misconfiguration or an attacker did X, if you're in incident response or whatever, to be able to say, like, I'm able to tell you this because I did that. I configured the exact same thing, a couple years ago. Right. So it's easy to be empathetic with people when you understand that you've made the same mistakes.
Totally.
No, yeah, you just judge them hard.
I would never do that, right?
But on your last call, you just called the customer. No.
Yeah, I've seen the Excel encrypted Excel file, right, in the root of it. The admin shares all the passwords in it and stuff, and it's like, man, to set up a password vault or something, and they're like, man, the cost of Delinea or you know, whatever, some sort of password manager, it gets expensive when we've got 70 admins or whatever. I'm just like, I totally get that. Yeah, we gotta work on that.
Yeah,
70. How many employees do they have? Do they have 70 admins?
Oh, it just depends on organization, but I was just making a scenario, but I've seen it a few times where we've got the, you know, Excel file on a file share kind of thing that the admins, we're the only ones that are able to access it because we did, you know, NTFS permissions kind of thing. And I get that. It's quick, easy. We just throw it in there and you're good to go, except, you know, that machine gets compromised or token stolen, whatever, we got issues, so.
I also seen it where it's reverse, where everyone is a domain admin on the network. Just because it's easy.
Totally. Well, you get like Active Directory is deceptively easy. Right? You get in there and you're like, oh, I can create user accounts and groups and objects and all this stuff, and like I can OUs and organize. And then you find like the KRB TGTs like moved into a disabled OU somewhere, and like there's so many things that are just they're non-intuitive. And so yeah, I totally get it. You get a sense of I know this pretty well, and then you get into it more and you're like, I don't know any of this.
Yeah, I remember working at a previous company where the CEO insisted he be a domain admin because it's his company, and I'm like, why? What is it that you need to do that you need to be domain admin? Well, just in case.
Just in case.
Last time before.
Yeah, usually it's like I gotta install some software, right?
No, he just went in. It was a pop. He just went in to be that, just to say he was to be that.
Yeah, we've seen the like accidental. Oops, I put domain users and domain admins, and you know that kind of thing. But it's always fun.
Nested, usually there's like one or two nested groups between there, right? So it's, yeah, the domain admins, it's the IT people, it's the marketing, then it's the domain users that all flows all the way through, right?
Right.
Oopsie daisy.
That's pretty funny.
Only if there was a tool that could tell you or check for you and see.
I know, right?
If you did that.
It'd be super cool. Somebody should create that. Yeah.
Or make it like a web app so you can just get live monitoring and stuff like that. That'd be really nice.
Hey, look, I forgot to put the scroll message on.
You're trying to do this.
Yeah,
now.
Look at that. Check it out. I was like, don't I have something that goes across the bottom of the screen that has this cool company that does stuff? Yeah. All of your Active Directory security needs, as well as Entra. Yeah. And coming up, check out trimarkvision.com.
So one question I have written down for you, Ethan, is being an Azure Entra, whatever the hell you want to call it these days, expert, what are the top 10 things you think people should be doing or checking they have configured in order to make sure that, you know, they have some level of security or some level of, you know, safety?
Oh, man, that's, yeah, that's a tough one. Identity as a control plane, you know, using conditional access properly, like basically deploy all the templates, right? MFA all users, all cloud apps, that kind of style, right? Administrative accounts, especially once Microsoft Authenticator goes phishing resistant here pretty soon. I think the simplicity of being able to sign in, just, you know, hold your fingerprint on there, type in the PIN, should make it a lot easier for folks that are still using like dual purpose accounts, like my productivity account. I just go and elevate in PIM or something like that, right? Separate those accounts, have a cloud only admin account. But just same sins we've always had with Active Directory, right? Identity handling, we just haven't done a great job of it. We run our admin accounts on our works, on our productivity workstations, and typically like help desk will have admin rights on our workstations and things like that. Same thing happens in cloud. Intune is managing the same device that the global admin is using, you know. So it's hard not to repeat those same errors. So like just handling identity is difficult, but utilizing conditional access if you have it, or security defaults, those are pretty sane configurations. So protecting identity, definitely one of my key tenets there. Even if you're just leaving Windows as default settings, right? I'd invest more time in identity hardening on that side than I would endpoint hardening.
I think that covers like your top five, I think, right? Like the identity is 1 through 5 at least.
Yeah. And one thing that I think a lot of people miss is conditional access is authorization. So it happens after we authenticate. So if you're getting blocks on like geographic regions or on legacy authentication or some of those kinds of things, like a lot of people miss that, like, oh, well, we blocked the attacker. The password didn't work, or, you know, they don't really understand, oh, we already authenticated. We got username, password. Maybe we even got MFA, but then it was blocked by a region or something. So, and those are it's so hard to follow up on all those, because it's like, how do I differentiate and how do I, you know, whatever. But we're getting our identity token first when we're authenticating. Then whatever is the result on that identity token, it says what kind of MFA we used or what kind of authentication. Was it user pass or was it Hello for Business or whatever? That's all stamped in that identity token that gets played against conditional access. So when we're looking at those events, it's actually just outlining what method was used in the token that was provided to conditional access for evaluation. So that's a common miss right there. It's hard to see.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Does it have a firewall? Does it have a border?
Say what?
Is conditional access like a firewall? Does it have rules and order? Is there a default deny at the end of it? Is there an end to it?
Nope, it's a merge, you know. Yeah, so it merges all of them. So that's why I always recommend building it like a house. You know, you pour your foundation of here's our baselines. We've got our MFA all users, all cloud apps. Then half of those templates you don't even need to deploy, because it's saying, hey, let's require MFA for some basic things like admin portals or for admins in general or things like that, right? Those are for organizations like, I don't know, I worked in the school district. It was really difficult for us to get MFA rolled out. We had union pushback. We had teachers that just wouldn't. I'm not using my phone without a stipend. California has that law now. So there's some things that get more complicated, right, with MFA rollouts, and so that those policies are geared towards those organizations that are going to struggle kind of making that a requirement. But yeah, it's a great baseline. But then typically we'll have, like, you know, administrative accounts, they have their own that are more strict. So that just builds on top of that foundation. We have application-specific ones, you know, a VPN, credential vault, other things. Maybe we're requiring more strict requirements, phishing-resistant authentication coming from a compliant device, things like that. But we can kind of build that foundation up more, right, as some of those, replace some of those policies and just make them baselines at some point as we get it ironed out. But yeah, not a firewall.
And then another thing I know a lot of companies do, and I don't know, well, not a lot. I know the handful of companies I worked at before, I know I've seen this over and over again. I don't know why they do this. Is that if you're on a domain, automatically disable all the firewalls between computers. And I never understood that theory, why people would do stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, we had applications, Autodesk, you know, it'll like do multi-device rendering and different things. You can ship like rendering of things with Revit or whatever. Like, you can do all kinds of cool stuff with the clients talking to each other. And I think a lot of times they're like, well, we have this one application that's in use in our environment, and we just don't know where it's going to get installed. A lot of things aren't based on device management. They're just hand installed by help desk. And so we don't know where it's going to be used, so we just kind of default to turning it off.
Yeah, so instead of actually putting rules in to open up the firewall properly, this just sort of all the firewalls.
Exactly. Yeah. So you're not packaging the apps, they're hand installing them, so then they're not building a package that says, hey, when I install this application, let's also apply this policy to allow the firewall rules that are necessary for that application, right? So that's, it's definitely hard if you don't have any of those tools that you're currently using.
Yeah, and then one of the things we were just talking about is like, actually, I remember when Mac's Windows first came out with their built-in antivirus Defender, like the base, it was just like complete trash. It was like, you did not want to use this thing at all. But now, I have a hard time recommending any other AV out there. Windows Defender, for the most part, does a really great job. And it's included, it's installed on the kernel level, so it has full access to the kernel, and it can do all kinds of hooks. That's what I was about, hooks. I don't know why it slipped my head earlier. It could do all the hooks it needs to then capture any and look at different memory sectors and look at different behavior patterns to then, you know, do all the blocks it needs to. Whereas not all AVs will have that level of integration and access.
Yeah, most of the tools, tooling that Microsoft develops like that, they do open it up to the AV consortium and stuff so that they can hook into a lot of those things. But sometimes it seems unfair, but Microsoft is internally developing those, whether they see it as a gap in the product. And so then they're like working with the Windows team to create things, or whether it's, you know, hey, they saw these things in their own environment that they don't have visibility for. But they build a lot of stuff like the ELAM and the you know, the ETWTI and different things that initially they were the only ones that supported it. Well, that's because they built it with the team, with the Windows team or whoever, and then they made it available to the other AV vendors and stuff. So you'll still see, like, CrowdStrike does a great job, SentinelOne, some of those, they're still hooking in and reading a lot of those same capabilities. It's just they are sometimes delayed because Microsoft got the benefit of building it internally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're saying,
I don't think they're doing it maliciously to like lock out other vendors. They're just
sure they're not doing it for that reason.
Yeah. Sometimes maybe, but other things though. Just kidding. Yeah.
I mean, it's free. It's not like they're really making that much money off of the vendors. So.
Yeah, right? Totally. No, the EDR side. That's that's where they are making their money off of for sure. Just a nice EDR. I like it a lot. The telemetry is beautiful. And then if you are looking to do app control or, some of the other things that are kind of more Windows-specific, attack surface reduction rules, also part of Defender, the telemetry that it gathers really helps with implementing some of those things. It's a little bit unique.
Yeah. Way easier to implement ASR rules with when you have MDE or whatever it's called now than without it. That just having that log aggregation and everything is amazing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I saw the Hag was working on some ASR stuff for Splunk, which looked really cool. I think it was like collecting the events off of, using the universal forwarder. But we could also, PowerShell, just get win event style, grab all those event IDs that he was referencing and pull them all back central, right? WefWeck, something. But yeah, it's hard to get centralized logging for sure. Graylog was amazing for that. Winlog beats and all that configuration by the sidecar was pretty sweet for something they give away.
Yeah, just make sure you update. I think for Graylog, you have to do the subscription, unless you get, only a gig or something, or 2 gigs of storage.
If you host it yourself and you just run on-prem, it was unlimited, unless they changed it recently. But I was pulling in about 6 gigs a day for a few years, and it was pretty sweet, all the pipelines and everything else.
I wonder if you do the cloud version, that's when you have to pay.
Yeah, totally. Cloud version, they have a small free tier. So does Charlie Lima, Lima Charlie, and then Humio, I think is the other one. They have some free tiers that are kind of sweet for like home labbing and stuff. It's a really nice way to get your hands on experience with SIMs and things like that. Even Splunk has a free tier that's pretty cool. You can even deploy it out on Kubernetes and stuff.
Yep.
That's how I've been trying.
I was working with a network company like a year back, helping them create a Greylock system so they can put into Isaac's homes and stuff like that, and they can see like certain patterns and connect that with other systems to then alert them of any type of beacons or any type of abnormal random traffic that's going through the network. It's really nice. It was a nice feature, a nice thing to do.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I actually saw, Edwin, RootSec Dev, had mentioned like spinning up the guest network and then connecting your work computer to that when you're at home for work from home. I was like, that's pretty brilliant, actually. Make sure that it's like on its own dedicated network with usually isolation and stuff.
Yeah, I think, Security Onion also uses Greylock? I believe Security Onion also uses
it. It's Elastic. So Greylock is Elasticsearch database, but then they use their own like pipelines and engine and stuff instead of Grafana and, or not Grafana, what is that, the Logstash and all that. They're using their own stuff. But yeah, the Security Onion's all Elastic Stack based, or what used to be Elk. Yeah. Still super cool. I was ingesting a lot of data for that in my home lab as well. It's pretty beefy. Takes a bit of resources, but really fun to see all the like IoT traffic and stuff flowing in there.
Yeah, there was one command I was just playing around in my home lab, and it just wiped all the data. I was like, oh, that's what that command is. Because I was just learning security. I'm like, oh, okay. I mean, it was a test lab, so it wasn't that big of a deal, but it was just like, there was no warning, no nothing. Just run the command. It's like, there's your data. Hopefully you knew what that command was. Yeah. So that was pretty funny.
That wasn't your deadpan switch?
No, that's when I was just testing some network tools. Because I run a Unify system in my house.
Yeah.
Uh-oh, I just exposed what I'm running. And I was just wanting to see how good the actual IBS solution was actually doing. I guess like Cerakata or any of the other ones out there. And see if we really could capture things. So then I was using, because I believe in Security Onions, you could also replay attacks for simulation. At least I believe that's what I was using. It was replaying attacks to then see if the Unify system will actually catch it. Spoiler alert, it did not. But it's fine. They updated it since then. It's been a lot better.
You know, just
you love to bring up the dead man search, don't you?
It's
every time.
It's because you keep on talking.
Just roll out over there.
you keep talking about that time you blew up your entire network.
This was not this time. This was a totally different thing.
But now it's like the third different time that you accidentally destroyed everything in your home lab.
No, it was purpose. Yeah, well, that's the purpose of a home lab.
That's true.
Is to try out different things.
I feel like there's a story here.
There's so many stories. So one thing I did want to make sure that we got to, Nathan, and Jim had kind of shot this to me, so I'll kind of like lay it up with him, but it's we've already talked about on-prem, we've talked about a bunch of Linux stuff, we talked about Kubernetes, we talked about Azure and Intra. Like how do you keep all of this stuff in your head, and like, and how do you continue to stay on top of all of this?
TweetDeck made it a lot easier when I had it, and I took that away. But yeah, so lots of Twitter, just research, follow different people that are, you know, sharing content around a lot of that stuff. So I just learn based off of everybody else, really. I like the lab a lot, so I do kind of deploy like Security Onion and different things like that. Just play around with them, try to get a better understanding how they work. And I don't go like, you know, 100% deep on anything specifically. I tend to play around with it until I get really confident in the skills that I have developed with them, and then kind of move on to the next thing. I don't know, it's part of the ADHD thing, like just, well, moving on to the next obsession, right? That's what my wife always says. But just moving from one thing to the next, getting it to a certain level where I feel like, hey, if I ever have to pick this up again, I could, you know, really go deep in it, and then just kind of moving around. Yeah, lots and lots of reading. I don't tend to read books. I don't listen to too terribly much music and different things. It's just, I just really enjoy diving into how things work. And so I tend to read a lot of docs and a lot of people's blogs and different things like that. So, yeah.
Do you have like a list of sites or blogs that you recommend for people trying to get more adapt or more aware of Azure, Entra, whatever you want to call it tomorrow? systems?
Yeah, they're all over the place. Merrill Fernando with the Entra team, he has that newsletter that publishes just tons of people's blogs and stuff. Like, that's just a perfect place to go and find all of those. They did have that blog post on the Microsoft tech community or whatever recently that had a bunch of them in there too. But I've just got a whole bunch of bookmarks and Raindrop and different things like that that I'll go review. The ones that have RSS feeds, I was pulling them into Feedly. And then I just kind of scroll through that. So I don't even know what all of them are anymore. I just like go click through the bookmarks and things. But yeah, it's a lot of MVPs, a lot of different people that are just sharing content. We've got a lot of PMs as well from Microsoft that are active on Twitter. And so review a bunch of those. At one point I was keeping up with Reddit and Discord and all the other things, but it's just family life. It's hard to keep up on all of those. So I kind of cut back and just kind of stick to Twitter and my bookmarks.
Yeah. Lot of different rabbit holes you also on those systems.
Absolutely. So. Yeah. And then fortunately for me, work is we support all of the different Microsoft cloud technologies. And so the only thing that I've cut back on is Purview. For the most part, I get to cover them as part of my job. And I get to see some kind of interesting and weird, unique things. A lot of times it'll be private preview stuff that we'll be working with Microsoft with a client and things. So I'm very fortunate to get kind of the exposure to some interesting environments and things.
That's kind of like testing.
I'm pretty sure what I learned. Yeah.
It's kind of like testing in prod, right? When you get to see all this different stuff, your brain kind of starts connecting these dots and you're like, that doesn't seem like that should work. And then you kind of take it back to your lab, simulate it a little bit, and you're like, oh, okay, those two are, related in some way or whatever, right?
Yep. Yeah, we lab a lot. One of the things I love about Patriot, we shoot for like the 50% utilization, which is a lot lower than most consultants. And then the rest of the time is really focused on like labbing out scenarios, making sure that we're like developing things well for clients. So it's more quality than just pushing out quantity kind of thing. So that's a huge benefit for me to kind of dive into those things for sure.
Yeah. So for other people who are not in consulting, what he's talking about is 50% is like they look and see book time booked towards paid gigs. They normally, I think it's what, 70 to 80%. They like to
or
see.
Higher. Yeah, or higher.
That's amazing. So 50% is really nice.
It is. It's an amazing balance, especially considering we only do 4-day work weeks. So it's it's hard. So
2 days a week.
Basically, yeah. And calls 2 days a week, and then the other 2 days a week are, action items and labbing and architecture and all that fun stuff. Yeah. It's amazing. So super blessed to be there. And Joe Stocker's our CEO, we're entirely engineering led as a consultant agency like you guys are, right? And it totally changes the way that we approach things, like knowing how important that is and also how you can get burned out pretty easily. A lot of times I think normal CEOs or businesses, they don't really see the wear that does on engineers. Right, it's a little bit hidden. Sometimes we're not great at sharing that either with our managers and things. I'm certainly not. And so, anyway, having that engineering-led focus is super helpful when they know that's an issue and address it as part of the culture.
Yeah, because then even when you try to stay up to date on latest and greatest things that's going on, like you only have so much time. And then most people don't realize when we say 70 to 80% is your client time. Doesn't mean you get 30% or 20% of this, pure investigative research. You still got emails and meetings and so definitely.
And notes. Notes take forever for me because I just never know how much detail to put in there. And I'm like, well, what if they don't watch the video? So, and there's some people who don't make it. So I always like it's like a novella by the time it's sent over, and that takes forever, right? So, yeah.
And don't forget time cards. That's another. At least 10 minutes, 10% of your time.
Yeah. Yeah, which is another thing that's like, well, in ways that we limit how much impact that is. We don't track time at all. And that way we don't have to worry about like the additional time involved in that. So that's off the plate, which is cool.
Yeah. Is your mic working, Jim?
What's that?
Okay. For a second, it looked like your mic wasn't working. So, Jim, one of the things that me and Nathan were talking about right before we jumped on was what's it called again? Oh my God, I forgot. It is,
we talked about a few things, Steph.
passkeys. It was passkeys.
Oh yeah.
We're talking about passkeys, and you know, it's an interesting thing. Passkeys, depending on how it's implemented, in my opinion, goes against MFA. Because now you're storing everything in one system that's not required a phone or not requiring all of the things. So, to me, it's like a double-edged sword. Like, yeah, you get in a single sign-on, you have a passkey, you can just log in directly to the site, but then that system gets compromised. That's everything. You don't have it where they need a physical device. They need a physical presence to then really verify that it is you, in fact, that's actually authenticated. Just curious what your thoughts are.
I don't have a lot of opinions on passkeys right now. Haven't used one in, I've been out of that segment of identity for a little bit now, focusing on the on-prem stuff, and I just can't keep up with everything. So just trying to do Active Directory full-time is plenty.
It's big enough, right?
It is big enough. Yep.
We do get to bring some of it to on-prem with Cloud Kerberos Trust, which is kind of fun, but that's really still Kerb, I guess. So there's a proximity requirement for passkey. So we do at least need to like have an authenticator with us at where we're having the session. You can't do it remotely, right? So that's still a nice benefit. Even if it is stored in a password manager, somebody has to physically have that password manager signed in and use it. I'm not a fan of storing them in the password managers because then it really isn't locked into a secure enclave. Mm-hmm. So that's one downside to it.
One of the other things you talked about earlier, Nathan, too, was the difference between like consumer and enterprise when we're talking about some of this stuff, right? Because getting consumers to do anything better than a crappy password is like, okay, that's great, right? So also it's just the attack surface is so much different too. So I don't know if you want to kind of recover some of the stuff that we had chatted on earlier with some of that.
Yeah, so passkeys were kind of announced or really officially supported like October or so of last year. Like iOS, Android, all of those kind of had final support for it. So what changed with that over the older FIDO 2 was that the keys themselves could be synchronized. So previously FIDO 2 requirement was that it was bound to the device, like in a secure enclave. So whether that was a YubiKey, you know, in the security module or, you know, Hello for Business used the TPM, for example, that was FIDO 2 certified as well, well still is. So then passkeys all of a sudden now were like exportable keys. And the focus on that was consumer side. So we can prompt the user instead of having them create a password when they want to sign up for an account, we can say, hey, let's just provision a key in your secure enclave or on your device. That will then synchronize to your Google or Apple or Microsoft account. And then on all the rest of their devices, that passkey will exist. So when they go to sign in, it just prompts them for the passkey. They either biometric or type in a PIN. And then they are authenticated in on that device as well. So for consumers, it's a really nice win. On the vendor side, it's actually huge too, because they're no longer dealing with compromised accounts and recovery and all that kind of stuff. They do have to worry about authenticator or like account recovery for users who like got locked out of their Google account or iCloud. So I don't know what that's going to end up looking like. That's one that's kind of concerning. On the business side, though, we have provisions called device-bound passkeys. And we can also, most of the identity providers like Okta and Microsoft Entra, they're supporting what's called an AA GUID. So we can specify the specific authenticator brands or whatever you want to call it. So we could specifically say we only trust Phishing or Yubico or, the Microsoft Authenticator. We could, once that phishing resistant is available, we could specify the AA GUID and say users can only create passkeys that are stored through the Microsoft Authenticator, which is then enforcing the device bound provision. So, there's some neat things from the business perspective. And account recovery on that one is a lot easier because we, own the user account is ours, and we can work with the user to do recovery. Of course, we have a process, and that's a whole different thing that's harder. But, so I think it is the future. We get hardware attestation with it too, which is cool. Going back to Dave's thing, it is a... two-step single factor, really. On the identity provider side, we just see one authentication package. What's really happening is we're biometric or doing a PIN to unlock their protectors on the certificate stored on the authenticator. And then it's answering the challenge and then sending that along with some metadata over. So it's kind of certificate-based authentication, like virtual smart cards or something, but with additional hardware attestation, which is pretty cool. But the identity provider only sees the one package and just validates that. So it's kind of like one and a half FA, I don't know. But semantics aside, still way stronger than username, password, plus MFA. There's a lot of cool stuff happening, compensating controls, I guess, if you want to call it that, that are really nice.
Yeah. I was
Go ahead, Brandon.
No, you're fine. Go for it.
Okay. Nathan, earlier you brought up, like, in the Entra portal, global secure access is down towards the bottom. I feel like that was one of the things with the brand rebranding of Azure AD to Entra that really got lost in the shuffle, because it was announced at the same time, and all of the Entra internet access and the Entra private access seems like it's going to be a pretty powerful capability as a security service edge. Have you had much of a chance to lab that up and use it yet?
Yeah. So, we got to go to Microsoft to meet with the product team, see the roadmap, all that kind of fun stuff. So, there's some details I can share, which is kind of cool. There, they brought some people from the Azure side. Actually, one of the guys that did Bastion, Azure Bastion, right? He's actually one of the primary devs on the Global Secure Access client and all that. They will be baked into the operating system at some point with tamper protection, like Defender for Endpoint. So it'll be more of a sensor or whatever kind of thing, which is cool. It is a really impressive roadmap, and I'm excited to see how it shakes out. It's a little different architecture than you'd have with like a Zscaler or something. There's some unique things that they're doing that are a little bit more Microsoft specific. So I think that plays well to their strengths. But what I'm most excited about for them is the token binding and continuous access evaluation. So it will be brokering tokens for everything that's integrated with Entra ID. So now we can cryptographically bind those tokens to a device. Malware can steal it all day long, and then it's not going to work on any other device because it doesn't have the private keys that's brokered through that app. So that's pretty cool. We finally closed that off. So if you're using phishing-resistant authentication, and then we're also doing global secure access for token binding, the tokens are now finally kind of safer, right? I'm not going to say they're foolproof, but at that point, our sign-in frequencies that a lot of organizations might be using because they're concerned around theft, that might be able to provide a better user experience, right? If we're like, hey, users must do a new authentication every 7 days or something. We might be able to up that or something. So that's pretty cool. Continuous access evaluation, because the agent is actually like natively integrated into Windows and tamper protection and everything else, there's quite a bit of trust put into its understanding of what network it's connected to and things like that. So now we can actually revoke tokens immediately with Entra ID or other providers, potentially. To say, hey, this the network boundary has now changed, and so if a token is brought off the device, it knows it's now a new IP, or if it's a transition from, you know, hardwired to Wi-Fi even, if you really had that strict of requirements, you could literally say, hey, we now have different IP addresses, and we're going to adjust our tokens and things, revoke them, re-require authentication, things like that. So that's all the internet access side of things. There's two different sides of it. One is the Microsoft apps, which is going to be included in E3. So like everybody's going to be, or we would recommend everybody deploy it at that point in time. One benefit too that it'll bring is better performance with Teams and other Microsoft apps, because it's actually going to spin up infrastructure in Azure for your Microsoft tenant. It's dedicated to your tenant, just like an Entra. What are app proxy or some of those tools, right? Mm-hmm. So it'll spin that up, and then your users literally punch a hole right next out. They come out through that VPN tunnel right next to all the resources. So performance is better, less jitter in Teams, some of those kinds of things. Those are their goals behind that. They have areas where they can't build data centers, especially over in Europe, where they're like latency and other things. They have difficulties with ISPs or hairpin NAT or other scenarios that they're trying to address. And so it'll provide a way better experience for a lot of those users. Especially with like Windows 365 and other things that are more, they don't like latency much.
Yep.
So there'll be some wins there for sure. The all apps, though, in order to route those through that tunnel, is going to be an additional license, from what I understand. So we're still waiting to see what that shapes up to be. So that's a bummer. The private access side of it, we still have the intra-app proxy, which is the legacy, quote-unquote legacy app. Not deprecated, just not really maintained anymore. Like, our new features aren't going to be coming to it or anything. They did add complex apps, so we can now do cores through it, which is cool. But the new client's a rebuild from the ground up for the private access. But we can do really neat things like protocol-based MFA. So if we're accessing LDAP or SIFS or printing or whatever we're doing, like, we can actually interject MFA in real time on those conditions, which is going to be huge. It changes on-premise GID.
Yeah, no, there's with the private access, it seems like there's a lot of really amazing things coming out of that. And when they announced it, it also looked like, in some ways, that they were extending legacy authentication through that to those service edge clients. And maybe I don't understand that correctly, or maybe it's something that's still in development or under NDA, but it almost seemed like they were bringing NTLM to enter private access, and that seemed pretty scary.
So not necessarily NTLM. We can do the Kerberos delegation, and if we did punch in IPs, there would be that downgrade to NTLM. Like, we still have the same issues we've always had, from that perspective. Yep. But yeah, as long as we're properly giving FQDNs setting it up right, we can do Kerberos constrained delegation. To make sure that anything that's getting passed through there is good. There are some weird things. I know, I just recently saw awake coding, right? But he was saying that, if you tunnel over SSH, apparently it downgrades the NTLM. That was news to me. Mm-hmm. If we're doing RDP and we're hooking in with Global Secure Access and saying, hey, to RDP to our servers, we want to interject MFA into that process, and then we use a conditional access sign-in frequency every time, right? So every new RDP session would then require an MFA prompt. So finally we get that duo parity, but it's actually applying to the protocol. So every time that RDP connection is made, that Global Secure Access client kind of says, oh, hold on, and then prompts the user and make sure that all that conditional access policies have completed properly, and then lets it go ahead and flow on through. So there's some cool capabilities, but it will be extra license. Again, it's kind of like a Zscaler-ish type solution. They're not gonna say it's gonna have all the same features. It's not nearly as polished, right? Because it's new, still in development, but maybe someday, I think that's their goal.
Yeah, gotta get that new E7 bundle. It'll be great. They've got enough add-ons now that are above and beyond E5. It kind of it sucks, and it's scary that all the added add-ons that are somewhat compelling or even almost required that are above and beyond the E5, which kind of historically had been thought of as the top level of all the licensing. But that's pretty wild. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, if we looked at app governance, right, that started out as an add-on SKU, and then they moved it down into just being part of E5. I would love to see that happen in a lot more different areas. Like, EPM and Intune should absolutely move into that. It can't be that much infrastructure, and my goodness, an MDM that provides that out of the box, a big selling point. So yeah, there's just
out of the box for the same price. You mean?
Well, yeah.
Right. No add-on cost associated with it. You don't have to go buy a third-party product either. Because a lot of MDM vendors don't have that kind of capability, right?
Yeah. And I feel like if some of Microsoft's really enormous customers that can do things like delay LDAP channel binding and entire patch cycles were to speak up on some of this licensing stuff, maybe it would change, but maybe not.
The thing that always bothered me with that is, okay, if we're holding some things back for a few select customers, just build in the I don't want it registry key and just inform the handful of customers, hey, we're pushing this default, go apply your registry key so you don't get affected. I don't even care if it's documented, because you know who's going to be affected by it. Just let them know, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
That seems to be the way that they've been deploying a lot of stuff recently, too, was that here it is, you can set it early, it's going to automatically going to be switched by default, and then you could always switch it back, right? Like, that's kind of their three-step process they've been using, so.
And step four is no documentation, all limited documentation. And
There's a lot of... Tertiary control is the name for that one. They're Microsoft managed settings, and then it'll start out in disabled, and then they say, at this date, we're changing it to enabled, which is pretty cool. I like that method.
Yeah, it's great from like a middle ground between, you know, not making the change at all and, you know, to the benefit of some of those really large customers that can't or won't, to the people that want to be secured by default. And also, I think there's a really huge middle ground of people that just aren't even aware that they need to, you know, look at those settings and change them. They think, you know, I got automatic updates installed, I'm good. And that's not always true. There's a lot of things lately, within the last couple of years, that have been, you know, the enforced through a registry key, or even DS heuristics now. So,
yep.
And like that DS heuristics one, like, I wrote half of a blog about that whole thing around, you know, like the LDAP, rights and permissions for computer objects, and as it relates to ownership and stuff. And like, when I hit publish on the blog, it was like 2 days before that DS heuristics thing was supposed to basically go away, to where, you know, it would be automatic. And by the time the blog got published, Microsoft changed that and reverted it. So like, some of the stuff in my like, going back to it, and it's like, that's still not enforced.
They don't just delay it for a couple months. It's delayed for like 18 months.
Yeah, but I thought they delayed it because the performance on certain systems was causing it to cause bottlenecks in the CPU or something like that. And that's what they're trying to like tidy up.
You can either have security or you can have usability. All right, we've learned that.
Okay, well.
It's like the downsides of that, I can't remember the CV or the knowledge base article, but the one relating to the LDAP rights for ownership on computer objects, there wouldn't be much of a performance impact. There's another separate patch with some enforcement issues around offline domain join or dejoin or rejoining a computer account to the domain that they made, and that's caused a whole bunch of issues for a whole array of people that do automatic provisioning, whether it's through like VMware or MDT or whatever, and they've had to dial some of that back as well. But it's really challenging to keep track of all those. I tried coming up with a database or something, or even just a spreadsheet, and I gave up within 2 months.
I think the sprawl is like, you walk into that network closet where all the cables are not in any organization. It's just everything's all plugged in everywhere, and you just got to follow the lines and figure out which one's plugged in where. Like, I feel like a lot of those are just, what are we going to affect if we unplug this and recable it or whatever, you know?
Yep.
And you can't take it into account, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it gets really nasty. Really quick, for sure.
Yeah, you should just create a script that people can just download and run on their machines just to get the best embraced security system. Which that should be your next task.
There you go. I mean, I look at SmartApp Control, right? It's doing a learning model, right? To say, hey, what all would be affected if we implemented this policy? That would be a really cool way to do it. Like, I'm just looking at Active Directory, the objects, the configuration, all this stuff, and learning model is what would be the impact if we actually flip this bit. And then, hey, we find no impact based on the little model. Cool, let's go ahead and enable it. Or this would be unaffected, right?
It feels like if you had like Azure Sentinel with MDI logs shipped to it, telemetry for that would be a lot easier to gather up. Of course, you can do some of that stuff with log aggregation and log centralization, but it's still pretty challenging just from the logs.
Yeah, you saw Ned's quiz survey or whatever that he sent out, right? With the yep. And then there's questions around like, what if we hooked it into Arc? Yeah, I have a feeling that's what they're trying to do, is instead of having to have Defender for Identity, what if we were actually hooking it into Arc and able to do an analysis like we used to do with the log analytics, management solution, right, for AD, like the evaluation. They moved it over into Unified Support something now, but I have a feeling they're looking to do more like, hey, let's do some BPAs, basically, but they need that config in Azure to get computed by a log analytics workspace or something somewhere.
Yeah. The fun thing about that is I'm 99% against putting Azure Arc on any tier zero objects at all.
Yeah.
Like, unless you have an entirely separate tier zero tenant for those things that's all split off, there's no way you should be putting Arc on your domain controllers. That's
yeah.
That's not
so
good.
We can use WEC to get stuff off to a member server from DCs, right? And then from the WEC, then we put Arc and then pull into AMA. Like, that's that should be the process they should be recommending. And then that gives a chance for people to learn WEC, which is always good.
That makes more sense to me, but that's going to cut into shareholder value, I think. So,
yeah, it's not cloud, that's for sure. So I think it's also maintainability long term. They want to get rid of MMC and all kinds of other stuff. And I think they're just trying to avoid anything that's going back and touching that stuff. They don't want to maintain anymore.
Yeah, so we have a few minutes left, and one of the questions I still see on the list is Alaska. Why Alaska?
it did stop snowing at least, so that's good. We're almost in April. So I moved up to Alaska summer of 2022. It's been really fun. So I was born and raised in Portland, Oregon area. I went to school down, met my wife for college, right? And she's from Alaska. So we had four kids, and things were just, Portland's expensive, really expensive. And with four kids and everything else, and a lot of rain, it's actually pretty dark. I was surprised. I expected Alaska to be a lot darker because, you know, we have periods of time where we have sun for 4 hours a day. Mm-hmm. But it's actually been really nice. And so anyway, we moved up for some, her family's still here, her mom's still here. And pretty fun. So yeah. Lots of people have planes. We just fly around. It's pretty awesome, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you like down by the Kenai Peninsula area? Is that, if I remember right?
Yep, definitely. Yeah, cool. So down in that Kenai Peninsula area, lots of great fishing. So it's pretty wild. Just throw a line into the water and then you just, no bait or anything. You just literally reel it back in and you hook a fish and just pull them out of the water. It's insane.
Yep. You come back home with like 24 fish. It's like, what are you going to do with that? I'm like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, there's limits, but for us, because we have four kids, it's 75.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, 75 sockeye salmon, like the really, I mean, the most flavorful fish I've ever had. We just freezer and we just make salmon patties or grill it up or, you know, air fry it, whatever, like bread it a little bit for the kids. We eat it throughout the year. And then some people do hunting as well. I haven't had a chance to go out or anything, but, you know, moose is a little bit like beef. Black bear is a lot like a sweet pork. Interesting.
It's chewier than pork, but yeah.
The brown bear's nasty. You can't do it. But it's super fun. If you like outdoor stuff, lots of snow. Down in the peninsula, the temperature's not too bad. So you see places that are like, Fairbanks is the worst, negative 40, negative 50 degrees. It's nothing like that. If you stay down.
And that's during the summer.
Yeah, it's like 30 degrees. It's pretty great, yeah. I think our highs are like 68, 70s, somewhere around there for the summer. So, yeah.
68 with black flies, right?
More mosquitoes. That's our state bird.
What's up?
They are huge. Hold on a second. Spray up here, or we've got those mosquito magnet things, which are just weird. Like burn propane and they fly into it, get sucked in and stuff. Yeah.
So working at home is awesome. Apparently, I've got somebody at my door. So you guys keep talking for a couple of minutes, and then I'll shut the stream off in a minute.
Yeah, So Alaska's pretty fun if you like snow and stuff. And right now we're getting close to my least favorite time. Don't come during spring. Don't come during fall. Either do summer if you enjoy the fishing and hunting and outdoors kind of stuff. Otherwise, if you like the snow, come up in the winter. Early winter's best. You still have that fluffy snow and it's soft. It hasn't gotten the ice intertwined inside of it or anything, right? It's pretty great.
What part about spring don't you like? Is it just boggy and wet, or
For where?
The spring. What part about spring don't you like for Alaska?
Yeah, so because temperatures will rise at least where we're at through a lot of January, February kind of time frame. Even sometimes later December, we'll get this melt off. So you get these layers of ice that start building up. So then during the spring, it's basically all ugly. It's just, dirt everywhere. And you get chunks of ice, but nothing melts evenly, of course. It's different temperatures in Earth and whatever. So anyway, you just got giant potholes. We call it breakup season, but it's just, sheets of ice with holes in it everywhere. It's just not fun. I don't know. You can't really go out and play in it. It's just, pretty cool.
I remember
Southern Alaska. It's huge. It's one third of the lower 48. So,
because we live in upstate New York and we got snow a couple of days ago. We got a bunch of snow. And then I remember when my oldest son, who's a Marine now, when he was a Boy Scout, we had to do camping I think for Boy Scouts, you got to do 4 or 5 camping trips a year or something like that. Anytime we had to go, I'm like, we're doing winter camping. I am not going out in the middle of the summer camping around here. It is just too horrible of a temperature. He hated it. He hated winter camping. And I'm like, it's the best time. You don't have to deal with mosquitoes. You don't have to deal with any of the animals just roaming around. You can just relax, enjoy it. He's like, yeah, but there's nothing to do. I'm like, you make a fire, go ice fishing. There's a ton of stuff. Play on the frozen lake.
Or we call them snow machines up here. They're snowmobiles, but whatever. But those are always fun. You rip around those. We've got some pretty big lakes up here, and you can just, haul. And it's pretty fun to slide around on those, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always worry about those and taking them on the lake. Because I know you're supposed to check in, make sure it's so many inches of ice and all this stuff. It's just
once you've had enough cold weather, though, we'll have -10, -15, something like that for a little while, and when it starts to get safe enough. You'll watch the pilots. That's how we always know. If they're taking their planes out and launching off the lake, I'm not following through.
It was I'm in Minnesota, and it's been a pretty awful winter from a Minnesota perspective. It's been too warm, and we just got snow this last week for the first time since November. But it was a record year for people going through the ice with their ice fishermen, ice houses. I mean, even up in northern Minnesota, the ice was so awful that they were constantly rescuing people off of ice floes or chunks of ice that broke off or whatever. A lot of trucks and stuff went in. So yeah, people aren't always very cautious, but if you're landing a plane on it, I would go out in that.
I can just imagine going on the lakes and going into your house to do ice fishing, and then open the door to leave, and you just realize you're on an island, just floating, drifting away.
No, thank you.
Yeah, there's some ice fisher people are really hardcore about ice fishing, and it's pretty scary sometimes what they'll do to get out there.
Yeah. I always think of Grumpy Old Men. Such a fun movie.
Yeah.
What's crazy to see people actually start a fire on ice while you're ice fishing. It's just like, really? You sure you should be doing that? And yeah, it's fine. Don't worry about it. You'll be fine. Right. You're not going anywhere. It's like, I don't know. I'm the paranoid type. So it's like, okay. I'll sit next to the door.
It's fun for sure. Yeah, I guess the Jim, is the no snow and that kind of stuff better for the wildlife up there?
Thank you. We're almost done with TV, okay? maybe for the pheasants, but they're not particularly native here anyway. So a little bit for the deer, because they could find browse out in the forest the whole time rather than having to come up into the cornfields and stuff, which also made deer hunting pretty awful this year. It's just gross because there's no, you know, there's all winter long it was brown and just icky, no snow to cover up everything, so the ground never really froze, and we didn't get enough moisture either. Like we're gonna be going into a really dry spring without
the dead plants.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because here we had so much snow last year, it was actually really hard on the moose and the caribou and different things like that, and like just mass die off. Because the calves, they just didn't make it, right? Sure. So we're kind of excited because this year it's not been great snow either, but like it's been really easy for them for grazing and different things. So
yeah, I mean it's got to be pretty bad to be hard on moose. Those things are wild, wild and crazy, hardy. So yeah.
Someone jump a 12-foot fence.
Wow.
What?
It was the craziest thing I've seen in my life. Like, I don't know, 1,000-pound animal just right over the top of that.
I didn't know they could jump that high.
I didn't either.
I'm sure it wasn't a reindeer and it was just actually flying.
At that point,
yes.
Yeah, like, in some ways, I'm more scared of a moose than a bear, because like you know that a bear is gonna, you know, either it's hungry or it's not, or it's pissed at you or not. The moose just doesn't care. With, you know, 12-foot tall fence, your, you know, semi truck, whatever, it doesn't care. It just does what it wants. Has no fear.
Happy, no babies, they're good. But it's funny to watch them. They'll just walk around town just using cars as salt licks, because you know all the salt they put on the roads and stuff for the ice. So you just walk around, they're just like cleaning cars and parking lots and stuff. It's so funny.
Awesome.
Yeah, just don't get near the babies. That's the
important.
All right, you guys ready to wrap this thing up? Did you do the go around without me?
Nope. Nope.
Cool. All right, let's do it. So Nathan, we like to kind of close out by just sharing either something great about your week, something you're looking forward to over the weekend or next week, or if you really had a really crappy week, then we're here for that too. So Dev, do you want to lead us off?
Sure. So one thing we're working on over this week, at least me and Jim, was looking at a certain file that there's like, oh, there's a ton of parsers for it, just we're gonna just look at the code and leverage that. And no, there's not a ton of parsers. Like, yeah, there's code out there that don't really analyze the file or do anything they're supposed to do, but we found a way. That's not my, and my other big win is I'm on vacation next week. Yay.
Ooh.
Someplace warm. Nice and warm. Beach. Looking forward to that.
All right. Jim, what you got going on, man?
I guess I'm looking forward to B-Sides Charm coming up next month. My wins have usually been helping Dev lately get something to work and testing that it does work. Really enjoying rabbit holes.
Yeah, so I know, Jim, you'll be at B-Sides Charm. I know we've got some people that are going to be at CypherCon, which is coming up next week, right? I think that's right. So, yeah, Trimark will be at both of those representing. And then later in May, Jake and I will be at B-Sides 312 in Chicago area. So, Nathan, what's going on with you? You got a win of the week?
Yeah, a couple little things, I guess. Working with certain clients where it's, hey, we really want to do this specific thing. And you recognize that, you're deploying labs or something, right? And it's Well, we want everybody to be able to use their own, look up their own passwords and things like that. And hey, let's talk about a different way to do that. So those kinds of wins where it's been, we actually need a different solution for this. And maybe client management is a better way to tackle it. So we've had some really cool conversations that I'm excited about, like people are getting, which is awesome. And then it's been just an amazing week on Twitter, Frank McGovern, and then you guys inviting me to join, and like just lots of, I feel the love. So that's been a huge highlight for my week.
Great. Well, we're blessed for having you come on, and thanks for tolerating me tweeting just random crap at you probably and bothering you.
Oh, that's great.
But I guess my quick win will be just a kind of a plug for next week. Is it's kind of funny that Dev asked you for the top 10 things you would change in Entra, because Trimark is doing a top 10 things to fix in Entra. So Scott and I are working on that setup right now. We will be talking about identity very heavily, and we're going to kind of be drawing some similarities between on-prem and cloud. So I'm excited about how that's coming up. Hopefully, we just found a really cool, cute slide deck. So we'll see if Sean doesn't veto it, because it's got some cutesy things in it. So I'm looking forward to that. That's coming up on Wednesday. So we'll do that Wednesday afternoon at 2:00 Eastern. So you can check me out there. And for everyone else, I will close us out. Thanks for coming, everybody.